Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran slams the U.S. president for accusing Tehran of destabilizing activities in West Asia and says Washington is seeking to create tension in the region by resorting to the failed policy of Iranophobia. The Qatari emir blames Israel's settlement constructions, blockade of Gaza, and attempts to change the demography of Al-Quds for instability in the Middle East. Also ahead, as our correspondent reports from Seoul, a new wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea with cases doubling to 40,000 per day. Thank you for joining us. Iran says the United States is trying to foment tension and crisis in West Asia by resorting to the failed policy of Iranophobia. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remarks in reaction to U.S. President Joe Biden, who accused Iran of destabilizing activities in West Asia. Kanani also slammed Biden for raising false accusations regarding Tehran's peaceful nuclear energy program, while ignoring decades of deception by the Israeli regime as the largest possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. During an address to the GCC Plus 3 summit in Jeddah, Biden said the U.S. will remain as an active player in the region and will not walk away to leave a vacuum to be filled by China, Russia, or Iran. The 2018 brutal murder of Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi has stolen the limelight during the U.S. president's meeting with the Saudi crown prince. Riyadh has once again tried to deny the involvement of Mohammed bin Salman in the journalist's killing.
The president raised the issue of Jamal Khashoggi at the beginning of the meeting with His Royal Highness the Crown Prince, and the Crown Prince responded that this was a painful episode for Saudi Arabia and that it was a terrible mistake that the kingdom launched an investigation into this matter, and that those who were accused were brought to trial and they were convicted, and those who were found guilty were convicted, and they are currently being punished by serving terms in prison.
Bin Salman told Joe Biden that Saudi Arabia has taken action to avoid a repeat of mistakes like Khashoggi's killing. The MBS also took a jab at the U.S. for highlighting the case. It turned the spotlight on the U.S. military abuse of prisoners at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison and Washington's stance toward the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghla.
His Royal Highness also mentioned to the President that mistakes like this happen in other countries, and we saw a mistake like this being committed by the United States in Abu Ghraib, and that the United States took steps in order to deal with those who are found guilty and to ensure that mechanisms are put in place to prevent sure that it doesn't happen again. And he also raised the issue of the Palestinian-American journalist that was killed by the Israeli Defense Forces and the need to ensure that this issue is properly dealt with.
On Friday, the U.S. president told the Saudi crown prince that he held him responsible for the murder of the Washington Post journalist. But MBS denied any responsibility. U.S. intelligence agencies say Bin Salman ordered Khashoggi's killing in the Saudi embassy in the Turkish city of Istanbul. The Emir of Qatar slams Israel as a major source of tensions in the Middle East. Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani says instability will persist in the region unless the regime stops its violations of international law. The Qatari Emir noted Israeli settlement constructions, the regime's attempts to change the demography of Al-Quds, and its blockade of the Gaza Strip as the root cause of instability and tension. He called for the need to find a just solution to the Palestine issue, adding the matter is a central cause for the Arab and Muslim people. Sheikh Tamim made the remarks during the GCC Plus 3 summit in Jeddah. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to the latest Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, calling them another crime committed against Palestinians. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem said the bombardment of Gaza and the intimidation of innocent people are part of Tel Aviv's atrocities and terrorist behavior. He stressed that Israel will not be able to shatter Palestinians' will and resistance, despite all its terrorist tools and U.S. backing. He said Palestinian people and groups will press ahead with the resistance until the Israeli regime is forced out of the occupied territories. Early on Saturday, Israel hit Gaza, saying the attack targeted Hamas military positions in response to rockets fired from the territory. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, says Israel fired at least a dozen rockets into the besieged territory, causing explosions there.
The amount of rockets that were fired by the Israeli regime were very high. At least 12 rockets were fired, and loud explosions were heard all over the Gaza Strip. This Israeli attack is the first time in 1 month, and it's the first time to happen under the leadership of acting Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid. The failure of the Iron Dome interception system to intercept one of the rockets, that's 50% failure. And I think this is a message by resistance groups by firing the rockets to in reaction to the visit by U.S. President Joe Biden, who on the first leg of his trip to the Israeli regime visited one of the factories that manufacture the Iron Dome missile interception system, and this shows you 50% failure of such systems. Last year, during the Sur al-Quds battle, the failure almost reached 80%. As more rockets being fired, the failure of the system increases.
The COVID-19 Omicron variant BA5 is surging in South Korea, with new daily cases doubling to 40,000 per day this week. The surge comes as another Omicron variant has been detected in the country, with growing concern about public apathy. For Frank Smith, reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue the changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place.
The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains.
Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn.
I know that more than 90% of corona can be prevented by wearing a mask, but if people keep coming inside and taking off their masks, I feel like it will be impossible to stop the spread. So the government should take stronger measures in that area.
People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A sizable number of lawmakers blame the West's aggressive foreign policy towards Moscow for the cost of living crisis currently impacting EU citizens. The 27-nation bloc is facing an energy crisis after cutting off oil imports from Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing. All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We turn now about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran slams as extremely disappointing the life sentence handed to Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri by a Swedish court. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program.
Tehran has slammed the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Iran for hailing the life sentence handed to Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri by a Swedish court. Top rights official Kazem Gharibabadi says the rapporteur publicly supported the arbitrary detention and the sham trial of Nouri. Gharibabadi says this is extremely disappointing, especially as the ruling was based on charges brought by an anti-Iran terror group. Official says the rapporteur, Javid Rahman, should have held Swedish authorities to account for gross violations of Nouri's fundamental human rights. Gharibabadi says the UN official proved that he is trying to please Iran's enemies. Nouri was arrested in 2019 over allegations of human rights violations against members of the MKO terrorist group. He was sentenced in what Iran calls an unfair trial by an incompetent court. Paul Sheldon Foote, Emeritus Professor at California State University, joins us from Irvine, California. We also have Paul LaRudy, who's a former U.S. government advisor, who joins us from Berkeley, also in California. Welcome to you both.
Well, I'm curious, Paul LaRudy, when you have a court hand down a sentence like this, obviously it is aware of what it's doing, I'm guessing, but what is more, questionable here is the way that this cult group actually has access to politicians, whether it's from the U.S. side, either current or former ones, or from the European side. Why does the cult group enjoy that kind of privilege?
All cult groups and all terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others, they all enjoy an alliance, sometimes under the table, but they enjoy an alliance with the United States, because the United States typically will find any organization that is ready to fight against whoever the United States identifies as is its enemies, in this case Iran, and whoever is willing to cause problems for Iran, that's who they will be the allies of the United States. Never mind if this organization has in the past actually killed and assassinated Americans and American officials, too. It doesn't matter. The important thing is that these are proxy troops that can be used to fight against the designated enemies of the United States. That's what's happening here. They don't care if they're terrorists. They're ready to use them for this purpose. So what you have here is everyone taking sides. In this case, Sweden is taking sides with the United States. They've recently applied for membership in NATO, and they're choosing to do the bidding of the United States. This is not a neutral corps.
Okay. Paul Shelton Foote, you had the former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo actually pay a visit to Albania, where this group is actually headquartered, and was received there. Why would the U.S. want to display this out in the open like that, like in this particular visit by Mike Pompeo that was made recently?
Not just Mike Pompeo. You have hundreds of Democrats and Republicans in Congress who have voted for resolutions supporting the MEK. They have, many of them, if not all of them, have received large donations from supporters of the MEK for doing this. The corruption is beyond belief. And in the past, numerous political officials have gone to MEK conferences. My favorite one is Newt Gingrich, where he almost got in his hands and knees and couldn't get over praising Mario Murjavi enough. It was total embarrassment to anyone to watch his groveling in front of a leader of a terrorist organization, a shame to all Americans.
Why would you think he would do that, though?
Mike Pompeo imagines that he's going to run for president next time.
No, I'm talking about Newt Gingrich. I'm talking about him.
Oh,
the incident that you mentioned. I mean, that's as you said, it's pretty low to want to do that to a ringleader of a cult group.
That's right. Well, Newt Gingrich is a member of the arch neoconservatives who are willing to use anything to extend their power around the world. They want total domination. I call them neo-Trotskyites because the founder of neoconservatism was at one time in his career a Trotskyite. And so it's old wine in new bottles. I mean, Trotsky wanted to rule the whole world as a communist, and they figured out that didn't work. So just put in a new bottle and call it democracy and still rule the world.
Okay, very well. Thank you for that. Paul LaRudy, former U.S. Government of Values Center from Berkeley, and Paul Shelton Foote, a pleasure. Emeritus Professor, California State University from Irvine, California.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Months into his premiership, Johnson was forced to admit that the UK was more geographically unequal in terms of income than any other major industrial democracy, says Sasha Bromsky, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Boris Johnson spends last days in office laying minefield for his successor. Here's more on the issue. a day after Boris Johnson resigned as British Prime Minister but announced that he would remain as caretaker Prime Minister while the Conservative Party chose its new leader, the disgraced leader was hit with another scandal. Several media outlets reported that one of the reasons he wanted to stay in office for a few months was so that he could continue to have access to Chequers, the PM's country residence, where he and his wife, who had gotten married during the COVID-19 lockdowns, were planning a belated wedding bash. Others gleefully reported that any incoming resident to number 10 Downing Street would, as first order of business, have to replace the extraordinarily gaudy and pricey gold wallpaper and other baubles that the Prime Minister and his wife had ordered installed using money donated by lobbyists in their official residence. Johnson's tenure was defined by lawlessness and cronyism, dolled up by his carefully cultivated shambolic charisma and his ability to turn a phrase to his advantage. He was, as the Observer and Guardian columnist Andrew Ronsley put recently, a master of verbal flatulence void of any underlying philosophical principles. On Brexit, he talked a big talk of getting the job done and implemented changes that led to startlingly high inflation and low growth, to a damagingly weak currency, and to almost daily diplomatic spats with the EU. On leveling up the economy, he preached about the need to economically boost depressed areas of the country. Yet, by the end of his tenure, inequality, including the geographic divisions that Johnson decried, was up, and reliance on food charities was becoming a defining feature of the economic landscape. The Gini coefficient, a number used to measure inequality in individual countries, rose slightly for the first 2 years of Johnson's premiership. When it fell marginally last year, that was due to the COVID-19 pandemic and the initial hit to top earners' wealth in 2020 rather than to broader long-term policy changes. Months into his premiership, Johnson was forced to admit that the UK was more geographically unequal in terms of income than any other major industrial democracy. On COVID, he talked of the need for everyone to pitch in and sacrifice, yet it turns out that he and his colleagues were cavalierly breaking their own lockdown rules pretty much whenever the opportunity presented itself. As with Trump, Johnson felt a need to install loyalists around him. While Trump's loyalists were almost all white and Christian, Johnson's government was more ethnically and religiously diverse. Yet, despite that fact, its members generally shared the same elite class position and opted not to force the larger-than-life PM to share the spotlight with them. In the end, when push came to shove, Johnson valued sycophancy far more than diversity of opinion. Given this, it's something of a miracle that Johnson sowed so much discord and distrust that even the loyalists, who had spent the last several years compromising their own decency in pursuit of power, felt the need to resign by the dozens last week so as to force an end to his calamitous tenure in office. Now that he has resigned in disgrace, Johnson seems to have no intention of going quietly into the political night. Within a day of resigning, the caretaker prime minister had put together a new cabinet, many of whose members were promptly decried by conservative insiders as being so politically toxic that their presence in government could only have been considered by a prime minister looking to set in place political landmines for whomever his successor might be. His die-hard supporters were already launching whispering campaigns against the front-runner in the succession race, the ex-chancellor Rishi Sunak. And despite promises not to embark on any controversial policy initiatives during his month as a caretaker, Johnson made it clear he would continue his policy of unilaterally ripping up the agreement with the EU regarding the trade routes and inspection protocols in and out of Northern Ireland, a policy that threatens to trigger a trade war with Europe. There are, at last count, at least 15 likely contenders to succeed Johnson as Conservative Party leader and thus as Prime Minister. Some of them are backbench non-entities who will surely fall to the wayside over the coming days and weeks. But several others are top cabinet members who will be in the campaign for the long haul. There is Sunak, who until last week was the Chancellor, the rough equivalent to the US Treasury Secretary, though with more powers to set tax rates and craft a governing agenda. There is Lee Trust, the hardline Foreign Secretary, and there is Transport Secretary Grant Scapps. Then there is Attorney General Sola Braveman, who has made a name for herself championing the most right-wing of Johnson's policies, and who many in the British commentariats have described as being the most Trumpian in temperament of the whole gaggle. It's likely that Sajid Javid, whose resignation from his position as health secretary was, along with Sunak's exit, the trigger for the revolt that led to Johnson's demise, will put his hat in the ring, as will the fiercely anti-immigrant Law and Order Home Secretary Priti Patel. In this list of contenders, one can see the outlines of a Conservative Party at war with itself. There are One Nation moderates, such as the ex-military man Tom Tuggelhat, but there are also a slew of hardliners who care for more about the old Thatcherite project of lowering taxes and deregulating the economy. There are those opposed to recent national insurance tax increases and those who argue that every penny allocated for vital social goods, such as increased spending on the National Health Service and subsidies to tide poor residents over during this period of historically high energy prices, need to be paid by taxes leveled not on the wealthiest but on ordinary, already financially strapped residents. Despite Johnson's efforts to purge the party of anti-Brexiteers, there are at least some contenders who would, if asked privately, probably want to round out the sharpest edges of Britain's ugly divorce from the EU. On the other side of the divide, there are those who would like nothing more than to make Brexit as hard and as ironclad as possible to entirely separate the UK from Europe's Human Rights Court and to shred the environmental and workplace rules that broadly harmonise the UK's labour market with that of continental Europe. Throughout, as this political saga has unfolded, the Labour and Liberal Democrat parties have largely been sidelined, watching as the Conservative tear into each other and as their standing with the public has created. Some Conservative Party insiders have reportedly started talking about the prospects of the party splitting in the face of this bloodbath and these irreconcilable political differences, as did the Labour Party in the early 1980s, with disastrous consequences for its election prospects. Labour's leader, Sir Keir Starmer, himself not the most charismatic or imaginative of leaders, was until recently also facing investigations by police into possible breaches of COVID lockdown restrictions. But last week, the local police force involved cleared him of any wrongdoing. Now, in probably less than 3 years after Johnson led the Conservatives to an election victory that resulted in an 80-seat parliamentary majority, a newly refashioned Labour Party is far ahead of the Conservative in the polls. If these were an election tomorrow, Labour, which is generally seen as being less corrupt and more in tune with the needs of economically struggling voters, would, according to these polls, come out with roughly 50 seats more than the Conservatives. As a result, it would be in a strong position to be able to form a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, the Greens, and a smattering of nationalist groups, though the Scottish Nationalists in particular would likely drive a hard bargain before agreeing to support a Starmer premiership. Last month, when Johnson survived a no-confidence vote in his leadership, he made it clear he was hoping to rule for a decade. Now, barely a month later, he is about to be out on his ear, having suffered one of the most stunning turnarounds in British political history. Johnson, the individual, will soon be departing Downing Street. And Johnsonism, as a political project, has hit the rocks. Moreover, the party that he presided over so ruthlessly since 2019 is sliding into a summer of knives-out political infighting that could easily fracture it for years to come and ultimately lead to its electoral implosion 2 years from now when the next general election is held.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear friends. And how about some mind-stimulating words from Imam Ali al-Hadi, peace upon him, whose birthday we marked yesterday? Do not feel secure from those who disgrace their own personalities.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, relationship between parents and children. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In today's lessons, we will be talking about the relationship between parents and children. In the Islamic lifestyle, you realize that there are so many things that are being expected of a parent or of a child upon the other party. A child is expected to treat their parent with respect. A child is expected to treat their parent with a little bit more respect and more understanding. And the same also is expected from a parent towards their child. Now, we want to talk about a few mistakes that have been realized, that we realize or we gain, that have been studied or have been seen from parents doing it upon their children. You see, parents are trying their best to upbring their kid in a good manner, to make them good people, to make them good personalities in the future. So a parent is trying his best, but still, as the parent is trying to bring up the kid, you realize that they're doing a few mistakes in their lives that will make his results not be the same results as he needed, as he's looking up to. That will destroy the results. He's trying his best to make sure that the kid becomes a good person in future, becomes a good leader maybe, a good person in the society and such like things. But in the end, they end up doing a few mistakes. So what are some of these mistakes? I will state one amongst them. It might be possible that some will put all the blame on the parents alone because of the fact that they have much experience in life and they were expected to be forgiven and possesses a wider heart and mind and more understanding to life than the kid does. So based on this, we will not forgive children, upholding blames on them. However, because the responsibility of parents are great, we will look into the mistakes of parents only for now, which if it is treated well, if it is put in a good manner and we look at it in a good manner, we will realize that the gap between children and parents will be filled. Now, it's upon us to realize, to know that whatever we see from a kid, whether it's a mistake, whether it's a good deed, Sometimes, or most of the times, this particular deed the kids is doing or the kid has just done is a result of the upbringing of the parents of that particular kid, of the guide of that particular kid. What we need to understand is that it's not just from the parent side, but it could also be from the child side. Now, we'll get back to see or to know more about the few mistakes that a parent does while he or she is trying to upbring their kid. Stay tuned, don't be far from us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is A to Z. We are talking about the relationship between a child and a parent, the relationship between children and parents. Now, some parents treat their children very harshly, the way they were treated by the parents as if they inherited this harshness. You see, a parent may be treating their kid or their child in a way that he or she was treated before with his parents or with her parents. This is not what we're expecting. This is not what is expected in Islam. Islam states that you should treat your kid according to the times that the child is living, not according to the times that you lived or the time that your parents lived. So some parents treat their children very harshly. Here, we are not going to discuss this matter and study the effect of our relationship for the future of the family's relationship. Rather, we want to tell these parents who are fond of dealing with such negative relationship that remember the effect and your hatred on harsh treatment your parents used to do on you. The first thing you should have in your mind is that you should remember, when my parents brought me up, they used to be harsh on me. What did that do to me? It really destroyed me from inside. It destroyed my confidence. It made me less confident than I am. Maybe I would have been more confident in the future or in my life if they would have treated me with a little bit of some kindness and not the harsh treatment. So how can a father who lived in such a harsh condition and treatment feel good to see his son in such a situation? Is it good for a father to always shout and beat his children for a minor mistake? And you know, like to be talking in a wild and horrible voice in the house as if he is a small executioner? So we need to check on how we treat our children and reduce the harshness on how we're treating them. And in the end, we definitely are going to get good results. Thank you so much for listening. Fi amanillah. Bye.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Children in Qatar are helping a conservation program revive the population of a critically endangered species of turtles. The children help release the baby turtles after they hatch, which usually takes place during the dark hours of the evening. The hawksbill mothers are cared for, if needed, when they arrive at the beach to lay their eggs. When the little turtles emerge, the weaker ones are taken to facilities at the foundation. There, they are cared for until they are strong enough to be returned to sea. Program managers say getting children involved helps raise awareness about the endangered species and how they can help prevent some of the challenges these turtles face.
As adults, we are kind of beyond hope. Our brain is no longer plastic. We can't really learn new things. But children have the power to really internalize all these things that they're learning, that they're seeing. They make these habits part of their life. They make decisions based on, is it good for the environment, alongside with economic value for money kind of decisions. And this is what we want to cultivate.
The children also get a chance to form bonds with the hawksbill turtles. Some of them have even named the one they are going to release. That's why life experts with the conservation program say only 1% of every 1,000 hatchlings make it to adulthood. Poaching, climate change, fishing nets and marine pollution have all contributed to the dwindling numbers of the species. The program was launched roughly a decade ago and has released 30,000 hatchlings into the sea in the last 5 years. Experts are optimistic about the success of the program.
The more scientists make progress in space exploration, the more they get persuaded to delve into the mysteries of the universe. Now, the release of stunning full-color images from deep in the cosmos has put astronomers on the edge of their seats. NASA has unveiled high-resolution pictures from its James Webb Telescope, which is the largest space-based observatory ever launched. The images took 2 weeks to render from raw telescope data. The $9 billion infrared James Webb was launched on Christmas in 2021. It reached its destination in solar orbit nearly 1 million miles from Earth a month later. Then the telescope underwent months-long process to unfurl all of its components. James Webb is now finely tuned and fully focused. The telescope is expected to shed light on the life cycles on planets of planets and galaxies.
The International Fajr Fashion and Clothing Festival has drawn fashion designers from Iran and around the world. The designs displayed are trendy and at the same time they conform to the Islamic dress code. Yusuf Jalali has this report.
It's the Iranian fashion's biggest day. The 11th Fajr Fashion and Clothing Festival brought under one roof fashion designers from across Iran and some other Muslim nations to step up their designs.
I have participated here as a fashion designer. I am so happy to be a part of this event because it acts as a platform that links designers to producers and it helps like promote quality design in the market.
This festival is a major event in the Islamic world's fashion industry because it helps promote fashionable clothes that conform to Islamic guidelines.
A typical Iranian woman wears a button-up coat called manto and a scarf covering the head. Some others wear a piece of cloth called chador, which covers the body from head to toe. One of the challenges Iranian fashion designers have to deal with is to tailor their designs to Islamic dress code or hijab while keeping them trendy.
Clothes represent the identity of a nation. As a designer, my mission is to design clothes that best represent the dresser's nationality and their culture. At the same time, the aesthetic aspect of the garment needs to catch the attention. I think this is an ultimate artistry if accomplished.
Smuggling is another persisting problem in the Iranian clothing industry. Out of the $8 billion annual turnover of Iran's garment industry, a whopping $5 billion is supplied through smuggling, say activists here. Experts say one of the reasons smuggling has the lion's share in Iran's clothing market is that it's more cost-effective to import foreign clothes rather than produce them domestically.
We are making our best efforts to push down the production costs, including the associated taxes, in order to promote designs that reflect our Islamic and Iranian identities, opposed to Western designs that seek to dominate global markets.
With all the actors in Iran's fashion industry present in the Fajr Festival, the event is seen as a place to highlight and address the challenges with the aim to provide the stage for Iranian fashion activists to shine in the domestic market.
It might seem contradictory when we would associate fashion with the Islamic dress code. What is the art of a fashion designer that sews traditions to style and designs clothes that are both stylish and hijab? Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Elephants are the largest living animals on Earth that in many cultures are associated with good luck, wisdom and fertility. But their overpopulation has become a matter of concern in the southeastern African nation of Malawi.
We want to reduce the population of elephants in this park, in Luanda National Park, because currently we have 600 plus elephants in this park. We would be comfortable, ecologically speaking, that is, to have 300 elephants in this park.
Officials say they will relocate 250 elephants from a national park in a southern town to another park by the end of July. They say the plan is part of a national conservation initiative to maintain healthy habitats in the country's national parks. Establishing viable elephant populations and ensuring the prosperity of local communities around the parks are said to be the other aspects. Residents say the elephants often stray into their gardens and damage their crops. Authorities had relocated some 300 elephants from the same town in 2019.
A zoo in Mexico City celebrates the birthday of two very special residents, bringing cheers and excitement to visitors. Chinese pandas Xin Xin and Xuan Xuan have turned 35 and 33, becoming the oldest pandas in human captivity. China gifted their ancestors to Mexico back in 1975 to boost the relationships between the two countries. Later on, and thanks to the hard work of caretaker teams, 8 cubs were born from the parents. Zoo officials say for them, learning the A to Z of panda care was a long journey.
The pandas living in Chapultepec, Xuanxuan and Jinjin, turned 35 and 33 years old, respectively. When their parents arrived, we didn't know much about pandas, so vets and biologists had to follow recommendations from those who took care of giant pandas in the People's Republic of China. From then on, we evolved. We found new and better diets and daily care practices such as vaccine administration or parasite removal. Then they started to breed, which was quite a success since it was the first panda that was born and which survived named Toy.
The birthday celebration has coincided with the zoo's 99th foundation anniversary. A panda's normal lifespan is estimated at about 15 to 20 years for those out in nature and about 30 years for the ones in human care. But the good news is, despite their old age, Xuanxuan and Xinxin are in perfectly good shape. A goat in the Pakistani city of Karachi has made the headlines for its not-so-ordinary looks. The animal owns strikingly long ears. Simba was only born last month and his ears have already reached the length of 54 centimeters. The goat's breeder, Muhammad Hassan Narejo, says he has approached Guinness World Records to see if Simba can be included as the greatest of all time, or the goat, for this peculiar feature. The kid is in the center of attention, so he receives all sorts of help to live a smoother life. This includes a special harness for his ears and daily religious rituals to wish him good health. The breeder says that by promoting Simba's image, he is trying to introduce Pakistan as a major goat breeding nation.
The sky is the limit for wind sports in Iraq's Kurdistan region as members of the paragliding team launched into the sunset. Tourists have also come to watch team members bravely run towards the edge of the cliff of Mount Asmar. They usually take off facing the west to catch the sunset and then glide down towards the grey green meadows. The windy landscape around Iraq's northeastern city of Sulaymaniyah is a hot spot for paragliding. Participants of the sport say it requires a lot of physical strength and mental concentration. Some say their favorite aspect of the activity is the intense silence when flying high above the ground. A young British artist has found an incredible way to create art using not pen or paper, but typewriter. Symbols and letters are turned into complex drawings by this 25-year-old's adept fingers, gaining him attention online. London-based James Cork, who studied architecture, used to draw portraits. But that all changed when he discovered his now signature tool, the typewriter, in 2014. He says the idea came to his mind when he came across Paul Smith, an artist from the 1920s, who produced similar work. Initially, Cook thought it impossible, but he gave it a try. Now, after 8 years, he can draw complex images from Hollywood star Tom Hanks to the London Eye or the Millennium Bell. But while his works appear flawless to viewers, Cook says it never gets any easier and that it's always a challenge for him.
There's something really satisfying about kind of using this sort of limited palette of... You basically have about 44 keys on a typewriter on average. So you've got to kind of puzzle piece those letters, numbers, punctuation marks together to make a drawing.
Recently, online interest has encouraged Cook to pursue his passion. People donate their typewriters to Cook, who gives these machines a second life. He now has a collection of more than 40 typewriters dating from the early 20s.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
More guns and tanks are of no use to Americans without housing, education, or health care, said Democratic Representative Barbara Lee. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, $839 billion military budget is a policy failure, say critics as House tees up NDAA. Here's more on the issue. With the U.S. House set to vote on legislation that proposes a staggering $839 billion in military spending, progressive lawmakers and advocates said recently that the bill exemplifies the war priorities of Congress at a time of growing hunger, rising child poverty, an ongoing pandemic, and other pressing crises. I've said it before, and I'll keep saying it until our federal budget is equitably distributed. More guns and tanks are of no use to Americans without housing, education, or health care, declared Representative Barbara Lee, who alongside Representative Mark Pocan has put forth an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, that would slash the U.S. military budget by $100 billion. Pocan, co-chair of the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus, wrote on Twitter recently that an $839 billion defense budget is a policy failure. Under the House version of the NDAA, the Pentagon alone would receive $808 billion for fiscal year 2023. Until they can pass an audit, Pocan argued, it's time to stop handing the Pentagon a blank check. The legislation that the House is expected to debate and vote contains $37 billion more in military spending than President Joe Biden's initial budget request, which totaled $813 billion, $802 billion of which was in the purview of the NDAA. Recently, the House Rules Committee is expected to determine which of the roughly 1,200 amendments that lawmakers are seeking to attach to the NDAA will receive a full House vote. Both Democrats and Republicans have proposed a wide array of amendments,